is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are seeing a 30% increase in murder compared to the 2019 period, which means that we are far more violent now, even during lockdowns, than we have been prior to the pandemic.
That's Lizette Lancaster, a crime specialist at the Institute for Security Studies, who says things are going from bad to worse in terms of violent crimes in South Africa. Details coming up. And in Nigeria, only 6 million out of 200 million citizens are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Sudan is bracing for more protests despite the military's reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Hundreds of protesters marched towards the presidential palace in Khartoum yesterday, defying bullets and tear gas to reject the deal restoring Hamdok. The deal signed with military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan faces opposition from pro-democracy groups that have demanded full civilian rule since longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. They are angry over the deaths of dozens of protesters in the weeks following Burhan's takeover a month ago. A hero for the protest movement, Hamdok quickly became the villain for some. Hamdok says he agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed. Medics aligned with the protest movement say security forces have killed 40 civilians in increasingly violent crackdowns, including one yesterday. For more reaction to the deal, International Edition's Chididu Ofor spoke with reporter Michael Etit.
Hours before the signing of the deal have been disappointed with the new deal. They consider the Prime Minister Hamdok signing the deal as a betrayal for the Sudanese revolution because they had a lot of hope in Hamdok to come back as a Prime Minister, but not to be appointed by the military leaders. They rejected, they say the deal does not represent them because it is a deal between the military and Hamdok. Political parties also have been so much also in rejection of the deal. Talking of the coalition of the Sudanese political parties that have initially signed the agreement, the declaration agreement between the military council, they rejected the deal, saying the deal gives more power to the military to continue holding the transitional period in the coming months. So they say they are going to, you know, mobilize Sudanese citizens to go on the streets and to reject this deal until the civilian government is reinstated back to Sudan to continue the transitional period until a national election is held in the country.
It appears Prime Minister Hamdok had no alternative than to sign on to the deal. Pressure from international community, from the UN, even internal pressure and protest by the Sudanese has been thus unable to push the military to have a change of mind.
It seems to be true that Hamdok has been put in a corner by the international community, by the European Union and African Union, as well as the military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, also has been put also into another corner. So this pressure has emerged, this agreement, that the two parties are able to agree in a new deal to begin transitional period for Hamdok to be reinstated as the Prime Minister, so that they are able to win the confidence of the international community. The international community is ready to cooperate with this new government, is able to give funds, is able to give assistance for the transitional period to go ahead. So it looks from the agreement and from the body and from even the timing of the deal itself, it gives a clear message that, yes, both sides have been so much under pressure, even though the speech of both leaders have the initiatives was brought by national parties, national individuals, national technocrats.
With political parties, some Sudanese groups roundly, as you said, condemning this deal, it appears that another round of protests will soon commence.
From the speech of Al-Burhan, he talked about the inclusion of participation. So that gives already a room for a new beginning, even if Hamdok is going to form a technocratic and independent government. That is still giving room for political parties to participate. He mentioned clearly that all the political parties, the door will be open for them to participate, in exception of the National Congress, the party of former, the Oster president, Omar al-Bashir. So I believe, yes, there are going to be more protests on the streets.
That was reporter Michael Atit speaking with VOA's Ginny Dofor from Khartoum. Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok said today that maintaining economic gains from the past 2 years was among the reasons he had decided to return to his post. In an interview with Reuters, Hamdok said he believes a technocratic government would have a chance to improve living standards and could work towards completing a peace deal signed with some rebel groups last year to end years of internal conflict. He emphasized that he still is committed to the country's democratic path, along with freedom of expression as well as peaceful assembly. The international community has cautiously welcomed the agreement that freed Hamdok and other officials detained since the coup. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged all sides to further talks and redouble efforts to complete key transitional tasks on a civilian-led path to democracy in Sudan. The United Nations and African Union also welcomed it, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which have strong ties with the Sudanese military. However, in Sudan, there is considerable opposition. The Sudanese Professionals Association, which played a key role in the uprising against President Omar al-Bashir in 2019, accused Hamdok of committing political suicide. The group tweeted that the deal is an unjust attempt to bestow legitimacy on the latest coup and the military council. In a month, the world will be watching as about 2.5 million Libyan voters line up to vote for their new president, with some of the country's most problematic figures among the 30 or so candidates. On the top of the lists are General Khalifa Haftar of the Libyan National Army, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of the former leader Muammar Gaddafi, and Aguila Saleh, the parliament speaker, who is accused of tailoring the election law to fit Haftar. Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed al-Shanawi whether anything good can come out of these elections.
Aguila Saleh intends to run for presidency himself, so I doubt that he had any reason to strengthen or to do his probably strongest opponent in the East, Khalifa Haftar, a favor. Saif's candidacy, if it is approved by the HNEC, which is far from sure, would certainly be a challenge for the Libyan society, keeping his leading role in fighting the revolution in 2011 in mind. Many Libyans who have served and fought in the war against the Gaddafi regime did not forget about this. It is difficult to say how much support Saif al-Islam really has in the Libyan society. But even if he makes it into the second round, I don't think he could win, as there would be probably a rally of most of the other candidates against him. Regarding Khalifa Haftar, it could well be that he makes it into the runoff. But the presidential elections will be decided in the greater Tripoli-Misrata area, the most populous areas of Libya, and I doubt that Haftar has sufficient support there, and I also doubt that he would be able to fake the elections there. Aguila Saleh was active in public as a chair of the House of Representatives after September 24. So he does probably not fulfill the criteria of Article 12 of the controversial electoral law, demanding from candidates to resign from public offices 3 months before the elections. So I guess the HNEC will reject his candidacy. The same is the case for the serving Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabeiba. if he intends to run. This would be in contradiction to the very same electoral law. But even if Dabeba argues, and he could argue, that there was a vote of confidence against him on September 22nd, so before the September 24th, by the House of Representatives, there is still his, and I would say probably even more important, written commitment before his election by the Libya Political Dialogue Forum in February, where he promised, in line with the demands of the roadmap of this LPDF, not to run in the upcoming elections. The UN Security Council has endorsed the roadmap in a resolution which makes it legally binding. The rationale of this paragraph in the roadmap was that the interim government, which is entrusted to prepare and oversee the elections, should be impartial. There should be no conflict of interest whatsoever. So if Dabeba would be allowed to run, this could lead to some major troubles, as this would undermine the roadmap, the foundation of the whole current peace process. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi would certainly lead to a split of the country. I guess that if he dares to conduct the campaigning, even just in Tripoli or in the greater Tripoli area, he would be subject to assassination attempt. He is certainly the most controversial on the whole list. And if he makes it into the second round, there could very well be some riots even before the second round takes place.
With these types of candidates, can you expect anything good to come out of these elections? And could this election process end up in installing a new stable system of governance that will open the doors for a prosperous future for the Libyan people?
Apart from those mentioned, there are fortunately many other candidates covering the whole political and social spectrum of Libya. Among the favorites for presidency, I would say, are also less controversial persons like the former Minister of the Interior, Fateh Bashagha, the former Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Maiki, both from Misrata or with strong connections to Misrata, and the head of the Reviving Libya movement, the Sufi scholar and businessman Arif Ali Nayed, as well as several others. It is really up to the Libyans to select now, and they have the chance to select the right candidates they want to have for the runoff in February, because I strongly believe there will be a runoff. As there are more than 30 candidates, it is highly unlikely that any of them will reach the required 50% plus one vote in the first round on December 24. From my point, the best choice for the Libyans would be to elect a non-controversial, well-respected person who was preferably also not engaged in recent domestic politics. But again, let me underline, it is their choice, and the international community has to respect their choice.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. New attacks are being reported in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Local government officials say the attackers appear to be with the group known as the M23. In addition, security forces are still searching for five Chinese mine workers kidnapped in the region over the weekend. VOA's Kate Pondawson speaks with reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma for the latest.
The M23 troops attacked again the Rutshuru territory on Saturday and the last night. Saturday, it was in the park where they killed one park ranger after attacking two positions near Bukima. It's not far from Rumangabo camp. And last night, they attacked again two other villages in the same regroupment of Rugari, what is not far from Goma. It's around 40 kilometers from Goma. And according to locals, there was singing in Kinyarwanda and claims to be the M23, so the branch army of ARC, which is the Congolese Revolution Army.
Now, I understand there were also some attacks late last week. Are they related? Are they the same? Are the suspected attackers also M23?
Yes, in the last week there was attacks again, but the problem is there are many attacks in the eastern Congo now. And in Rutshuru, the most involved armed group is M23 at the moment.
Now, in addition, we've had the kidnapping of five Chinese mine workers in the region. Where does that situation stand? Have these mine workers been found?
Not yet. And it's not in the same region, but the Chinese were kidnapped in South Kivu province. And till now, no one know about who kidnapped and where they are being taken. FRDC said they are following kidnappers and operation are in that region. We could hope that they can find them.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. Violent crime continues to rise sharply in South Africa, already rated one of the most violent countries in the world by organizations such as the United Nations. Statistics released late last week by the South African police show sharp rises in almost all contact crimes in recent months. Social analysts say the nation's apartheid past, high unemployment and poverty are fueling violence, and the government seems to have no solutions. Darren Taylor reports that new crime trends are also emerging.
The government's fond of saying crime isn't so bad in South Africa and that the media exaggerates it. But each quarter, its own police minister, Bheki Cele, contradicts this when he releases crime statistics.
The SAPS crime data is again demonstrating that South Africa is a very violent country. This is evidenced by a double-digit percentage increase in all assault categories. Between July 2021 to end of September 2021, 6,163 people were killed in South Africa. That's a really bad number. This is 1,056 more people killed compared to the corresponding period in the previous financial year.
According to the World Population Review, only 7 countries have higher murder rates than South Africa. Crime specialist at the Institute for Security Studies, Lizette Lancaster, says things are going from bad to worse in terms of violent crime in the country.
We are seeing a 30% increase in murder compared to the 2019 period, which means that we are far more violent now, even during lockdowns, than we have been prior to the pandemic.
She says with an estimated 10 million jobless people in a nation of 60 million, hopelessness and desperation are sparking anger and frustration and nothing to lose attitudes. Cele says women and girls often bear the brunt of this.
Rape, again, bad news. 9,556 people were raped between July and September 2021. This figure of almost 10,000 people are raped only in 3 months.
A new, very worrying trend, says Lancaster, is the sudden spate of kidnappings.
We are talking about over 4,000 kidnappings that happened in this first 6 months of this financial year alone. About 5% are either ransom or extortion related. And then there's another 5% that is revenge related. This translates to around one a day on average in the country. And that's only the kidnappings that are reported to the police. As we know, because of the sensitivity of the matter, many are not. We are seeing more and more syndicates that have moved into the type of kidnappings that have made the news.
She's referring to recent abductions of the children of a few wealthy families. In one case, relatives paid the kidnappers 50 million rands or $3.3 million for the safe return of 3 brothers. Private investigator Pierre Guldenhuis says the criminal success in these cases is already motivating organized crime groups to enter this new sphere.
We're definitely seeing an uptrend in big cases and smaller cases. And what I also believe is we will in recent times also start seeing copycat syndicates. Because this is getting so much exposure, people will start to see, okay, well, this is working and this is a good way to make money, so let's try it. People are willing to pay a lot of money for getting your loved ones back, rightfully so.
Social media in South Africa is abuzz with warnings to parents to take extra care of their children. Hildene says there's now also unprecedented demand among rich South Africans for personal bodyguards for themselves and their children. Paranoia about crime in the country, already extreme, just went up a notch. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A former hotel driver goes on trial today in Paris, accused of complicity in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. According to the French news agency AFP, Claude Muhayamina is accused of knowingly driving Hutu police and militiamen called the Interahamwe to carry out massacres in Rwanda's western Kibuye region. One of the worst atrocities of the 20th century saw 800,000 minority Tutsi and moderate Hutu majority slaughtered in just 3 months. Around 50 witnesses are expected to testify at Muhayamina's trial. This will be the third trial of Rwanda genocide suspects in France. Its legal system grants universal jurisdiction to judges prosecuting crimes against humanity. Three people have already been convicted in France connected to Rwanda's 1994 genocide. Muhayamina, who was married to a Tutsi at the time, has denied the charges and says he was not in the Kibuye region when the massacres took place. In Nigeria, only 6 million out of 200 million citizens are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The government says everyone above 18 years of age should be inoculated and that all public and civil service workers must receive a shot by December 1st as fatalities continue to grow. From Abuja, reporter Monachi Chooks has more.
Authorities have vowed to bar government employees from their offices if they are not able to show proof of vaccination against the virus. Bas Mustafa is the chairman of the Presidential Steering Committee on COVID-19 and secretary to the government of the Federation. He confirmed the policy on mandatory vaccinations while inaugurating the mass vaccination campaign against the pandemic over the weekend. Mustafa says the campaign is one of the government's strategic approaches to quickly increase the number of fully vaccinated citizens in Nigeria.
All federal government employees are therefore reminded that December 1st, 2021 remains the deadline for all to show evidence of being vaccinated fully or a PCR negative test result done 72 hours before being allowed into government facilities, particularly their offices.
Under the effort, up to 1 million doses of the vaccine will be administered per day and up to about 55 million people treated by the time the initiative ends. In addition, the Nigerian Center for Disease Control, or NCDC, is helping states to implement preparedness and response activities against COVID-19. It is calling on all Nigerians to join forces and take greater responsibility for controlling the spread of the virus in a campaign called Take Responsibility. Dr. Faisal Shuaibu is the executive director of the National Primary Healthcare Development Agency. He says the organization is concerned about Nigerians who have refused to be inoculated against the virus.
It is important to add that today, none of the 6 million Nigerians that have received their vaccine have died as a result of the COVID-19 vaccination. What the data released by the NCDC shows is that over 80% of people who have died from COVID-19 are those who are unvaccinated.
Schreiber notes that the government aims to create additional vaccination sites in several venues, including hospitals, university health centers and clinics, pharmacies, mosques, churches, corporate offices and private health facilities. The Minister of Health, Dr. Sagie Ehanire, is also encouraging Nigerians to receive the shot.
I remind all persons that by taking COVID-19 vaccine, that would be one of the proven ways to avert mass catastrophe that unfortunately has befallen some countries.
The Presidential Steering Committee on COVID-19 in Nigeria says the campaign aims to have at least half of all citizens over the age of 18 inoculated by the 31st of January 2022. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks in Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baru, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.